Hello, everybody. This is Amanda Dennis. Natalia, are you on?
I'm here, Amanda. Hello. Hi, everyone.
Hello. All right. We are so excited about this call. Welcome, Life Force Families community, to our first Life Force Families call. Before we get into the call, I just wanted to go through a quick agenda. My name is Amanda Dennis, and I'm the co-founder of Life Force Families with Natalia. And just a real brief intro. It was about a year and a half ago that I approached Natalia about the creation of Life Force Families, which, of course, it didn't have that name yet. But all I knew is that I was a parent living this lifestyle, and I felt very, very alone. And the doctors, I couldn't really talk to the doctors. I couldn't really talk to my parents. I couldn't really talk to other parents either. So the idea was really very simple, that we create a place where parents, like-minded parents, are able to come together and really share and support each other. And that's really how Life Force Families started. And so one day I just had this flash of inspiration, and I picked up the phone and I called Natalia. And I left a message, and I was really nervous to do this because this is Natalia Rose, and I'm new to this lifestyle. But I was so thrilled when she called me back and said that she was thrilled and that she had been thinking about doing something like this for a long time too. So definitely a lesson in following your heart and taking action when inspiration occurs, but that's a whole other topic. So Natalia and I started this, and really between me having Sophia 9 months ago and Natalia having Electra 3 months ago, we feel like Life Force Families is really now at a point where we can breathe some fresh energy into it. And these calls, it's really the first start in that direction. So we're so excited to have you on these calls, and we so look forward to your participation and feedback. On that, if you have a question, you can either, at the point when we do some live Q&A, we'll instruct you to press 1 on your keypad when you have a question. The other thing that you can do is use the participant dashboard. It's included in the link that you got in your email. You can click on that, and then you can enter questions into that dashboard, and we can see those online, and then we can answer them. And just so you know, we can't respond to you, so if you write something and you don't get a response from us, that's why. So what we're going to do today is we are going to first talk about Life Force Families, what that actually means. What does a Life Force Family actually look like? We are going to talk about the Good Mother or the Good Parent Program. I'm going to give a little story about what that's meant for me, and then we'll talk about it again later at the end of the call. Natalia is going to give a recap of her beautiful Electra birth story, and then she's going to talk about the first 3 months. And even though she's already done this two times with Tundi and Tommy, who are 11 and 9, right, Natalia?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, she's going to talk about how it's been different this time. And we will hopefully have some time for some live Q&A, and then there's some questions and answers that have been sent in and that we've pulled from the community forum. And then at the end, we're going to do a brief meditation, and we're going to do some affirmations that will help us all reprogram or unprogram the Good Mother Program. So more to come on that. But Natalia, let's go ahead and talk about the name Life Force Families, why we decided to name the site Life Force Families, and what that really means.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome, everyone. And Amanda, thank you for that great introduction. I'm so glad you did call me all those, well, I don't know how many years ago it was now, but I can't imagine my life without you and without working with you. It makes it so much more of a joy. So Life Force Families, what does it mean? You know, it's everything in life is interconnected. When we think about our natural world, it's all about the interconnecting threads. Some are physical and some are unseen. So some have materialized. These threads have materialized into vines and leaves and strawberries, and the human energy body has manifested them in our muscle and skin tissue, our skeletal system. We see the manifestation of these connections in those ways, but there's also the ways that we don't see. We don't see the subtle energies behind the material form. And so there's just waves and waves of interconnected threads, we can call them, on every level, dimension, seen and unseen. And as long as these are flowing, and everything's unblocked, they can conduct, meaning they can send and receive life force energy, the source of all life. So when everything's open and flowing on every level, microcosmic, tiny little microbes to macrocosmically in the cosmos, then there is this beautiful feeling and sound and fragrance. Everything that can be experienced in the physical world is experienced at its highest level when all of this is conducting beautifully. It's also referred to audibly as the music of the spheres. So I'm sure those of you who are familiar with Shakespeare are familiar with the music of the spheres. And basically, at a microcosmic level, there are these little orbs, and these little orbs are spinning. And as they're spinning, both in the material and the spiritual levels, they are they're generating a harmony, a sound, a vibration. And that is the music that we refer to in the music of the spheres. So as long as that's unblocked, as long as it's given freedom to ring, let freedom ring, we can feel it ring through us. We can see it ring through nature. When you have healthy ecosystems and happily chirping birds of multicolors, and that wonderful feeling that rings through your chest when you feel like your life is unencumbered and open and you're feeling creative, when you actually feel childlike, maybe when you're, even 60, 70, 80 years old or older. So those are the signs of living in harmony with the interconnected world. When there's blockages, when there are blockages in that, and the ability for life force to conduct, then there's decay eventually, and there's it is something that winds up having to face and its end. In between life and the end, there's pain. So it's the suffering of the decomposition, and that's where we find our suffering. If we want to bring it home to our everyday life, that's where we find the blockages and the things that cut us off from our ability to receive and generate with nature and with each other. We wind up running into major obstacles that are very painful, whether it's depression on an emotional level, or it's physical elements on a physical level, it's relationship problems that come from blockages and inability to understand relationships and express properly because we put on armor, or because we never learned how to love. All these things are the evidence of blockage or a cutting off from the interconnected web of life. So families are just like our bodies, are just like the solar system. Everything in nature functions in the same way in this interconnected field. And so in the family unit, this means that the individuals are open and free and sharing, and on a physical level, on a spiritual level, on a mental level, on a communal level. And where there is blockage or separation in a family, there's going to be pain in that family, whether that pain is manifested as a child's illness or a parent's cancer or a parent's depression or a child's suicide or bullying or abuse or any of these things. These are all it's all evidence of that impeding the life force flow in what should be an interconnected network of conducting life force. So if we look at our world today, we can identify more evidence of blockage and separation than we can of harmony, beauty, creativity, and the interconnected flow. And what we want to have happen what we want to do is educate people about how to reverse that trend and make the harmony and the life force flow the norm rather than the exception, and eventually for that to be what rings around the world. And fortunately, more and more people are beginning to understand that the separation approach is doomed, and that the interconnected approach, even though it requires quite a bit of faith, is the approach that winds up healing everything in the end. So we're getting there, which is really exciting because of people all over the world of all walks of life tuning to this higher paradigm. And that's exciting. So Life Force Families is simply contextualizing that concept within the family unit. And Amanda said, you know, we're going to talk about what does Life Force Family look like? Well, you know what? We talk about the bridge and people going on the transition bridge from the undesirable paradigm to a desirable paradigm. And between that, there are so many steps, just like there are an infinite number of numbers between each integer. So there are so many steps along the bridge, but the fact that you're on the bridge and headed in the right direction is all it takes to become a Life Force Family. And so that might mean that there are you've acknowledged that what you did before was not harmonious, and you want to live more harmoniously. So you've cleaned out your cupboards of the brand name junk foods, and you've brought in the fresh produce, and you've cleaned out the clutter from your home, things you don't need. You're consuming less. You're having more family time. You're loving on your kids more. But it also might mean that as you're doing this, you're struggling because you don't like the fact that you've already made a lot of, you know, what you might call mistakes, but of course they're just, you know, opportunities to learn with your children. Maybe you spent many years in the workforce and you didn't nurse your kids and you weren't there and they were latchkey kids and they grew up eating sugar cereals and whole and regular pasteurized hormone infused milk and antibiotic chicken, and they've got asthma already and they have all these issues. Or maybe you're finding that your children are resisting you because you want to take the family in this direction, but they're already addicted to the paradigm they were exposed to because they went to school and hung out with people who were, you know, living the world's way. Those sorts of things only make you a participant in a Life Force Family. They don't mean that you're not a Life Force Family because those things are going on in your life. This is a place. There are many places to do this. This is a place for us to work through those things, because only through acknowledging them honestly and working through them can we find solutions to them. And we might find beautiful, seamless solutions to some and imperfect solutions to others. But most importantly, we're conscious of what's going to reconnect us and what's not going to reconnect us, so that even if we wind up having a family scenario that includes some compromise, we're still an aspiring Life Force Family, and we're living in the zone of consciously knowing that knowing what will heal us, so that we can bring more and more of that into our lives to the best of our ability under the conditions that we're living at any given moment, and moving, even if it's baby steps, in the right direction across the bridge. So that was kind of it was a long-winded explanation, but I feel like we needed to cover it really big picture, so everyone understands that they're all well. Everyone is welcome here. Even if you're tentative and you're not really sure you want to be a Life Force Family, you know, come and listen. And if something resonates, great. If it doesn't, don't worry. We're not going to be hurt. But we're here to serve at every level. So on that note.
Yeah. Well, and absolutely. And I think, the goal here, we say this a lot, is progress, not perfection. And so I think all of us recognize where the entire planet is in terms of being on a transition bridge. And the best way to think about this, too, is that our little immediate nuclear families are really a training ground. This is where we learn about unconditional love. This is where we learn about non-judgment. This is where we learn to forgive. And really, we're learning that. It's kind of like preschool or kindergarten. We're learning that so that we can become this world family, so that we can actually become world mothers and world fathers, meaning that we see our children as our children, but we actually see all children as our children. We see our family as our family, but we see the whole world as our family. So by us addressing the challenges that we all face at this nuclear family level. And I don't mean nuclear like the parents are married and it's, you know, the traditional looking family. What I'm saying is your immediate family by really evaluating the challenges that we run into, we're really helping the collective, the entire our whole human family in addressing these same types of challenges, because every time our consciousness level is raised as an individual and then within our family, that reverberates throughout the entire interconnected web that Natalia was talking about. So this is actually great work that we're doing. This is actually service that we're doing, and that we're standing up and we're saying, okay, you know, there's some things here that we know that we can work on, and we're doing this together, and we know that when we come together energetically, that it's so much more powerful. So by coming together as a group, by supporting each other, by sharing experiences, every time you share your experience, you're helping others heal. And so this is really an opportunity, and it's really a great service that you're all doing by stepping up and saying, look, I know that I want to grow. I want to become better. I know that there's room for improvement, and I'm willing to be honest and look at those areas of my life and within my family. So, you know, congratulations to all of you, and thank you so much for doing that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. It's a real leadership role. And we're going to give you tools so that you're going to know how to deal with your particular nuclear family obstacles. So to know that this is going to be a place for you to actually get tools, and it's not just going to be theoretical and a lot of, you know, high and mighty philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we were going to do on each of the calls is address some of the programming that comes up for people as they are starting families, wanting to get pregnant, having families, parenting. The programs that are within us are so pervasive, and so they can be so paralyzing that we it's difficult for us to hear our own voice and to really be guided by our own authenticity. So one thing that we want to do on these calls is address some of the most prominent programs that you are facing now, that you will face if you haven't faced them already, and then work to rewire. We've had so much brainwashing and so much it's really, you don't even know that you have these programs a lot of the time. They're like whispers in our ear, and so you think that these are your own thoughts, but really when you peel back the onion, you realize that they're not really your own thoughts. They're really thoughts that are part of the collective consciousness. Maybe, you know, for thousands of years, these are things that people have been thinking and been sort of kept small and limited by. So what we want to do is start to uncover those. And one of the things that we're going to cover on this call today is the Good Mother Program. And I want to really expand that to the Good Parent Program. But specifically, the way that this was uncovered for me, there was an event a couple weeks ago in which there were no keiki allowed. Keiki is children. And so what we do for this event that we actually attend monthly, it's a full moon ceremony, and it's a ceremony that adults participate in only because some of the things that come up for people are pretty big, and so children don't have the same sort of filtering mechanism, so it's to keep them safe. So it's not really even safe for children. So what we normally do is we bring a babysitter to the event location, and the babysitter takes care of the children. On this particular night, my three-year-old had a very unusual and very uncharacteristic bout of separation anxiety. She did not want mommy to leave. Mommy, don't leave. Mommy, don't leave. And while this was happening, I knew that what was best for me and what was best for the group and what was probably best for her would be for her to stay with the babysitter and the other children and have a fun night. But I became a little bit paralyzed in my decision making. So, long story short, I ended up compromising my role in this ceremony and having her come along with me. After the ceremony, I found myself, and I'm going to be totally transparent here so that we all can relate with each other, but I found myself kind of moping around. And and especially around my husband. And what I realized is that in reflection later, that I wanted him to feel sorry for me. So then the question was, well, why do I want him to feel sorry for me? And that brought me to the realization that I wanted him to recognize the big sacrifice that I had made that night to be a good mother, that I had sacrificed my happiness so that, you know, that my daughter would feel safe and secure, and that I wanted him to see that, look, you know, see how good of a mother I am. And then I went, whoa, why do I need him to be validating that I'm a good mother? And then it was so clear to me that I wasn't believing that I was a good mother. I didn't believe that I was a good mother. And when that came, that realization came, it was this, the, you know, dawning experience on me that all of these affirmations came in that were like, whoa, you know, what is a good mother? So actually, before that even happened, I was sharing this whole sort of train of thought with my husband, and he said, Amanda, what is a good mother? And I went, whoa, that is such a good question. And what happened was I was flooded with the program of what a good mother is. And there was a visual and, oh, a good mother does this for her children and sacrifices. And so, you know, I had all of these programs that came in. And then it was like, whoa, 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 whoa. That is not what I believe is a good mother. And so what resulted from this whole process was a flood or a download of affirmations of what a good mother really is, the truth of that. And really, there is no one good mother. There is no one right way. And we'll go into that. And so at the end of this call, I will share some of the affirmations that came through. And I just feel it's so important that we all support each other in reprogramming ourselves and living our authentic motherhood and that authentic experience with our children, not based on what other people think we should be doing, how we should be talking, how the family should look, none of that. How we know in our heart to parent and how we know in our heart to be as an individual. So we'll share that at the end too.
Yeah. We waste a lot of energy just keeping up with our programs, doing what our programs tell us to do. I mean, all that moping around and all that needing to, you know, it's almost like pulling teeth to try and get a response out of somebody else simply because it's our program they're walking around with and they're not even aware of it. And they don't even know that they're supposed to be responding back with that validation.
Yeah.
But no, I loved it that you shared that with me the other day, and I shared back with you that I even, in one instance, asked my own children if they thought I was being a good mother because I was so insecure about whether or not I was.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I think that was pretty comical to look back upon that and think, you know, wow, and we, you know, and the fact that, you know, that would have made them extremely insecure to be asked if they thought I was doing a good job. You made the joke that, you know, what if God were to ask us if we thought he was doing a good job, if he was being a good God, you know, how nervous would we be?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's funny, and I think it'll resonate with a lot of moms.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, you know, there is a way of gaining validation. And that's, as you said, you know, like really, really knowing in your heart that you're being a good mother and what a good mother really means. I look forward to you giving us a healthier program there at the end of the call.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, and one more thing. If you do resonate with that particular program, that it is individual, but at the same time, it's very collective. It's very much a thought pattern that is prevalent in our society today, and I'm sure that it has been around for thousands and thousands of years. Women carrying around this doubt, and men too, but I think especially women. So, you know that yes, you're experiencing that program, but at some level, you're not really responsible for the fact that it's prevalent. Now, we all are responsible for doing what we can to turn that program around and change the story at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Natalia, do you want to give us all a recap of your birth experience, please?
Yeah, you know, I think it really all started with, you know, the pregnancy and just, first of all, you know, just being very surprised to find I was pregnant and not you know, not sure that I, you know, could cope with another, you know, baby to take care of in my life. And I think I start with that simply because it all kind of came full circle. And the pregnancy itself was so incredibly seamless. I had my older two kids when I was, I think I was 25 when I gave birth to Tundi and 27 when I had Tommy. And so here I am 10 years later, 11 years, my daughter's actually turning 12 on her next birthday. So it's like, you know, it's quite a bit later and I'm, you know, a little bit older. And some would say, you know, well, I'm now kind of in a stage where, you know, a lot of women are having babies later in life today, but it's still considered to be, you know, getting up there to have a baby. And so when I had this seamless pregnancy, feeling physically in my power, throughout the whole entire thing, exercising with vigor every day, riding my bike. I eventually had to trade the bike in for the elliptical trainer at the gym, which going back into a gym after so many years was a funny experience. But I learned a lot about my own judgments. I had to let go of going back to a gym and, you know, the scene at the New York gyms and the whole thing and all the television screens. And that was its own kind of experience. But I was so grateful to have that elliptical trainer. And I highly recommend that as a great form of exercise while pregnant because there's no impact. But yet you can, in my case, I like to be aggressive with my workouts. And I was really happy to know to feel like I could be. And I just really went with my intuition. There were times I thought, well, what if am I getting too overheated? Is that going to be bad for the baby? And, you know, really, I just kind of went with my instincts and it all turned out well. But I had this really great, very high energy pregnancy. And that was, you know, it was nice to see that after, you know, being in the age group I am now. And I also was just remarking that after, you know, I'm now 3 months postpartum, but as of really just maybe a few weeks after having the baby, I was really in my power again and feeling strong. And I even said to a close friend, I said, you know, I can't believe, like, I'm completely unmarred physically by giving birth to three children. And you know, I think maybe it's a program, sort of that, you know, there's some wear and tear that has to be visible on the body or invisible, you know, internally, problems that develop from pregnancy and childbirth. And, you know, I wasn't born into this world with some super DNA or anything. I mean, I always feel quite the opposite. I've had to work extra hard to be in such physically good shape. But, you know, three pregnancies with, completely physically unmarred. I could honestly say that, you know, and I don't mean this in any vain way, other than the sort of the knowledge of what I was able to do physically to give birth to three children, this body doesn't really feel like it's been through anything, going through three pregnancies, three childbirths, you know, nursing three babies. And I think that's really kind of awesome. And I was thinking to myself when I was maybe 2 months postpartum, I had this little mental checklist of, like, you know, thinking of the concept of having a good body and that not meaning that you physically or visibly look like the paradigm of a good body, but that you actually have a body that is good, that works, it's doing what it's supposed to do. And I was thinking, wow, I have a really good body. Like, it does what it's supposed to do. You know, it's having to and carry a baby, and it does that, and it develops these, you know, a beautiful baby. And then, you know, then it has to go through the labor pains and give birth. And, you know, I was run over by a bus when I was 3.5 years old. It was almost fatal. It was a lot of internal damage. My pelvis was shattered, and the doctors, there were like five doctors who said, look, she's not going to make it. So if she happens to make it, she'll be crippled for life. And then they told my mom, look, you know, it's doubtful that she'll ever be able to have children. Wow. They thought that I think that my eggs were destroyed or something as well. But to my mother's credit, she never told me that there was any concern about me ever having children. And I think that net was never imprinted in my mind. It was the furthest thing. I would never in a million years have thought that infertility would have been an issue for me as a kid. But she always knew this, that they said this to her. Never pass it on to me. And I always wondered if things would be different if I carried that program with me. But at any rate, I, you know, defied the odds and was running on the beach within 6 weeks. And my body, you know, came back to, you know, it's in many ways, it's perfection, except that my pelvis kind of grew back with my bones grew in a little bit funny, and on the one side I have a bone that kind of juts out in a funny way. So I have these really terrible labors, and I think it's because my birth canal is kind of skew. That's the only thing I can explain it with, because it's supposed to get easier to give birth, and each time, you know, it hasn't been the case. But my actual labor this time was about 20 hours of active labor, and it was the most excruciating. I mean, I honestly thought I was going to die. And I will say that if any woman isn't fully committed to the idea of giving birth at home and nothing standing in their way, don't do this as a half measure. I suppose I should explain that I was planning to give birth in a birthing center with some midwives. That with my daughter, I gave birth in a hospital. They induced me. I went through all the, you know, the Pitocin and all that. I eventually was able to have a vaginal birth. I fortunately didn't have a cesarean, but I was on the hospital conveyor belt, which, in my opinion, is a dangerous place to be, and I never wanted to go back there after my experience giving birth to my daughter. So with my son, I found a birthing center with midwives and was able to give birth to him naturally, labored in the birthing tub, had wonderful midwives and everything. And I was going to do that same thing again, except that the midwives I was working with, the original ones I had with my son, after so many years, they had kind of split up and they were in different places, and I had to find a new group of midwives. And when I did, they had to follow a really medical protocol, which I was happy to kind of be flexible with, because I didn't see another option. And I knew that, you know, I did know the home birth option was available. And I went with my husband to meet with a midwife, and she was so off this planet, and her home was actually in shambles. It was actually physically dirty and messy, and my husband was already making a huge concession to even consider home birth at that stage. When he was confronted with this concept of a midwife, he just made me, as we walked out of her place, he just made me promise that we would do the birthing center, and that would be the end of that. And I was spooked enough myself that I was like, okay, honey, I get it. Don't worry. You know, I'll set that up. And, you know, enough said. So I started to go down this path as I thought it would be fine with the midwives and the birthing center. Well, I was agreeing to do a lot of things. I didn't want to do all these blood tests, all this stuff. But I went ahead and did it. And then with my first two, when they give you this this drink for the gestational diabetes test, and they want you to drink this highly intense sugar drink to detect whether and how your insulin response is and whether you have gestational diabetes. And of course, I know I don't have gestational diabetes. And with my other two, I convinced the doctors or the midwife to just let me get a smoothie with exactly the same number of grams of sugar, and they agreed, and they were fine with that. But this was 10 years ago, and now everything has to be, you know, by the book. There are no exceptions. Everybody has to do things the same way, because nobody wants to get any extra effort to you know, they don't want to have to manage, you know, somebody who's, you know, wanting to do things differently. At any rate, I asked them, they looked into it. They said my only other option would be to take a home blood test and test my blood sugar level 6 times a day for, I think it was 2 weeks or something crazy like that. Wow. I'd have to poke myself 6 times a day for 2 weeks, and then they would be confident that I didn't have gestational diabetes. So it was either that or drinking the drink. And so I thought to myself, okay, whatever. I mean, like, how anal do I have to be? Can I just drink their drink and just not be difficult about everything, because I'm difficult about everything and everything has to be my way or the highway? So let me just give in to this. So I said, okay, fine. You know, I'll do the drink. But the drink wasn't for a couple of weeks. And I thought I was okay with it, except I had this dream. It was a nightmare. In my nightmare, I was surrounded by the midwives, and they were making me feel really bad. I can't remember right now the details of the dream, except that I was crying and the midwives were bullying me. And I woke up and I just said, "Oh, you know, I just, if I know how the subconscious mind and the soul communicates, and I don't listen to it, that is just the most foolish thing, you know. To know something and then not to follow it is crazy. So here I am being given this dream that's so incredibly obvious. And if I'm not going to pay attention to the dream, then you know what? I should just stop everything I'm doing right now because nobody should listen to me ever. And I have nothing worthwhile to say if I can't listen to my own higher self. And so I thought, okay, well, you know what? I'm going to trust this, and I'm going to trust that I may not have the answer right now, but I'm going to have the answer pretty soon. Well, within the next 20 minutes, I had this idea I should call the placenta lady. The placenta lady is the woman who I recommend on the blog that I wrote my birthing story about, who will take your placenta and encapsulate it, create a tincture, and all these things that Amanda's story with her placenta inspired me to do, to look into this, consuming one's placenta after birth. And so I just thought, the placenta lady will know what to do. So I call the placenta lady. And I tell her my dilemma, and she says, is there and maybe a home birth woman that, you know, maybe or something. And she says, of course. She says, my midwife is the best. And, you know, she's now pregnant with her third, or she's probably maybe has had her, is having her probably as we speak, her third child. But she tells me about Miriam Schwarzschild, and Miriam has just this absolutely illustrious reputation. She's, you know, an ER room nurse, and she's just like, you know, so Lisa, the placenta lady, is raving about her midwife, and I have a feeling, you know, I'm not going to make any decisions at that moment, but my gut was, this is going to be good. And so I call Miriam, and I'm thinking, I just hope she can fit me in, because at this point, I'm 7 months along, 7.5 months along. Most caregivers don't want to take you on after a certain stage, and this is usually well beyond that stage. And I spoke with Miriam, and Miriam had a very busy schedule, but she said, you know what? I'm going to fit you in. And I just knew that everything was going to be fine at that moment. I set up an appointment with Miriam. We met. We had a great connection. And then I have a wonderful friend who's a doula, and I booked her in, and I'm so grateful to my higher self for the messages, for Lisa, for Miriam, for my doula, I can't say enough about. And it all just this amazing confluence of ideal people and decisions came together in that moment. And set the stage, which I think was really, you know, Electra's doing ultimately. I think every child, decides, you know, where she wants to be born, when, under what, which conditions, because it all has to do with her or his soul experience, certainly initiating this lifetime. And so I think, you know, she didn't want to be birthed in the birthing center and all this. Now, this is an interesting thing I found out later. My next obstacle would be much later, when I was getting beyond the 40, 41, even 42-week stage of carrying the baby. I never thought about not going into labor naturally, easily. It was my daughter I was induced, but it was the hospital. It was, you know, she was prematurely induced. She was 6.5 pounds when she was born. She could have sat in there and cooked a lot longer. But, you know, because I didn't have to wait very long with her, you know, after I think she was 41 weeks, they induced me with my son. When I felt like it was time for him to come, I drank some castor oil, and I didn't really think about it too much other than, like, you know, it just kind of feels right today, and maybe that was I feel like every child deserves to choose their own birthday, and I don't think in this case, looking back, that I was necessarily choosing for him, because it was so, like, the message was, today's the day, and anyway, maybe I did, maybe I didn't interfere, but at any rate, I didn't go so far that I ever sat around on my eggs thinking, when is this ever going to hatch? And I went into that with this one and, you know, started to read up on all the possible ways to induce your own labor. Now, here's the interesting thing, though. Had I gone over 41 weeks with Electra, I would not have been allowed to give birth in the birthing center. And I never even knew that. It wasn't until my doula told me when I was, you know, 43 weeks, you know, that this was the case. So I would never even, I would have wound up, if I didn't have a home birth scenario set up for myself, planned with a midwife, home birth midwife, I would have had to do the hospital scenario anyway, which, as, you know, as I've spoken of in previous recordings and the Beam Green videos, there is, it becomes virtually impossible to have natural birth, especially if you have long labors and difficult labors, without having an epidural in a hospital because of the way the hospital shuts your body down, and it just because it's totally inharmonious and out of sync with a natural childbirth. So I probably would have wound up in a highly compromised situation that was totally the opposite of what I would have wanted to have, especially for somebody who's as educated as I am. So it would have been a major fail. It would have been like, you mean you failed that test? I mean, you've studied for that one for the last 10 years. You've been preaching that one. And I would have walked right into this. So at any rate, I'm really glad that Electra switched tracks on me and things turned out the way they did. But, what did I want to add there? Okay. Anyway, so 43 weeks, I'm beginning to think, well, you know, everybody does have a baby eventually, right? And I started to go online and check this out. As you know, you can find anything online. And I find stories of women who were incubating for like 2 years, 4 years. And, you know, you're trying to separate truth from fiction, but some of the stories, you know, are pretty well doctored to look real. And so I thought, oh my God, well, maybe I'm just never going to give birth. Maybe I'll meet one of these women who is like 4 years pregnant. And so, you know, because you just, the biggest mistake is to stop trusting your body. The second you stop trusting your body, you know your choices are going to be way out of harmony. So then, you know, of course, my husband starts to get concerned, and my midwife is so chill. She's like, oh, you know, just somebody, I just delivered somebody who was like 43 and a half weeks. You're fine. She was so like, how can you be so fine about this? I'm 43 weeks, and the doctors, you know, and she's like, how are your fluid levels? You know, she sends me in to get the scans. Fluid levels are perfect. I've got so much fluid, you know, I could give somebody else fluid. And then, you know, how's the movement? You know, she's kicking up a storm. She's doing gymnastics in there, and yet there's no room and she's upside down. So, you know, that wasn't an issue. And so I went in for these tests now every other day at this stage practically. And, you know, I'm not the kind of person who likes to have lots of sonograms. This is one of those things I can see, you know, you can only guarantee that your baby's doing well at this stage if you have these sonograms and check the fluid levels. And everything was looking great. My husband was getting concerned, and the doctors who were doing the sonogram said, well, your fluid levels are great and the baby's moving fine, but if you were my patient, I would induce you tonight. Mm. Well, you know, that, you know, makes it, because we don't want to make mistakes. We don't want to, we're doing this, we're making these choices not because we want to be radical, but because we want the most healthy children. We want to bring about the highest possible outcome and not to serve, you know, our agendas. So I was ready to hear anything. I just wanted to do what was best for this baby. And again, my midwife is still totally relaxed about what's going on. And I say, so I started to take matters into my own hands. I got out the breast pump, stimulated the nipples like crazy. I went for acupuncture stimulating acupuncture, which I actually didn't respond well to. I found it very, very painful. And my body, I think it's because my system is so clean and clear that all the pressure points they used felt bruised and really like reacted intensely. So, but I didn't go into labor. I went, I think, 4 or 5 times for acupuncture. And I did everything. You know, you name it. I was doing it to induce labor. Nothing happened. So my midwife promised me that at a certain point she would strip the membranes. And that just separates. It doesn't. It's not breaking the water. It's just separating the. I believe it's like the cervix from I don't know, it's I can't remember exactly what it is now. But basically, that usually will do the trick, but not always. I was drinking the castor oil. It just made me feel terrible. I didn't have the same experience I had with Tommy. And at any rate, not to go on too long, after about maybe 48 hours of her stripping the membranes, I did give birth, but the birth was incredibly laborious, and like I said, 20 hours, it was so hard, I really thought I was going to die, and that's why I say, like, be prepared. I'd forgotten, you know, they say that you forget, and I'm thinking, how could I forget something this terrible? And I don't know if my son's birth was quite as intense as my daughter, as my second daughter's, but if it weren't for the incredible doula I had and the amazing midwife. In fact, anybody who's questioning getting a doula, I thought to myself, oh, I've got my husband. He's great. You know, do I really need a doula? Maybe it's superfluous. I never realized that home birth midwife, this may be the case for Miriam because she's busy, but she's wonderful. I wouldn't take this away from her, but don't expect your midwife to be with you throughout all of active labor. They usually come at the, you know, toward the very end. And in her case, you know, she came, my doula called her when she was probably only home with me for the last hour and a half. Mm-hmm. Out of 20 hours of active labor.
Usual, Natalia. I think
common.
That's normal.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. So my doula was she was the one who carried me through. And, you know, there were so many times when I just looked at her and said, there was no way back. I couldn't go backward. I couldn't take the pain away. I mean, and then I couldn't, you know, move forward without breaking through and going all the way forward. And there were moments when I really didn't think I could do it. And it was the most Herculean challenge, but also the greatest triumph of my entire life. Like that moment, that moment of 20 hours, challenged me to take me to places I just never thought I could go physically at all, emotionally, because the physical was so intense. And I remember, because I've always been, I'm the kind of person who's very self-critical and challenges myself to always, like, you know, be better and better and better. I remember in around maybe three-quarters of the way through just looking at my husband and saying, don't ever let me criticize myself again.
Wow. That's awesome. Wow.
Because I'm doing this.
Wow.
And I, you know, like, it doesn't matter if my body's not perfect. It doesn't matter if everything's not in place, if my home isn't perfect, if my kids don't get to school on time. You know, no criticism need apply for the rest of my life because I'm doing this.
Yeah.
I can do this. I'm doing this for my baby. I'm able to, like, stay with this. And I quickly forget that agreement, but it was that kind of intensity. And so, stick with it. We did, because there was no other way to go. And I was not going to do those contractions in a cab going to a hospital. But the tub was critical, as I think every woman who has a home birth will attest. It's definitely not an epidural, but it helps in so many ways. And my husband was incredible. He was giving the counter pressure for at least 5 hours. He was nonstop, having to work every muscle in his body to push so hard against my lower back because I was having this back labor. But the most miraculous moment was when we were able to receive her into the world together, and both of our hands, like literally my two pair of hands, were around her and were on her head as she was emerging. And I said, Lawrence, you have to feel this. And he was in the tub with me for the last like 5 hours, you know, pruning up and working out. And he's, you know, he at first was like, you know, it's okay, don't worry. And I was like, no, you have to feel this of her head emerging. And I think at that moment he just like went somewhere. He was so beside himself when he reached down. He could feel that too. And we brought her into the water together. And one thing that was just pretty extraordinary was that when I gave birth to my other two, they were small. They were 6.5 pounds. And so when their head came out, the rest of their body just kind of slithered right through. And so I was expecting the same thing. So I could feel her head. I'm like, okay, I can do this. And even though labor was tough, when it came time to push and I could feel her head, I was just like, okay, I can't take this pain anymore. I know the pain's going to end when the baby's out, for the most part, aside from the placenta. So this baby is now in my power to push out. I'm doing this. And so in one push, I got her head through. And I was waiting for the rest of the body to slither out. And then my midwife says, okay, I'm going to turn the shoulders now. Get ready for the shoulders. And I just said, even though I hadn't taken a breath, I said, what do you mean the shoulders? And so I was like, okay, I thought I was going to swallow the baby back up if I didn't get the whole baby out at once. So I was like, okay, you know what? I don't know how this is going to happen and how it's going to work, but we're going to keep this push in action. So with that continuous push, got the shoulders through. And the most remarkable thing was that she, even though she was 43 weeks, you know, there was no sign in her that she was overdue. She had plenty of the vernix, which if there was very little vernix, that would mean the vernix is the white sticky stuff, sort of the thick coating that's on the baby, and that was thick and plentiful. And there was absolutely no sign of there was no meconium in the fluid at all. There was everything indicated that it was just right. And even if she had to stay in there a couple more days or another who knows how long, everything was fine. Maybe our dates were off. Maybe there was something else that was off. It wasn't that she was supposed to and that my body wasn't doing what it was supposed to do on time. So if my membranes hadn't been stripped, she would have still been fine. And that's the beauty of it. But she came in just a slither shy of 8 pounds. So I just say 8 pounds. With the other two, giving birth, you know, in the other scenario, even though my doctors knew how to massage the placenta and, you know, they were great and the midwives were great, I tore with both of them. And I didn't have episiotomies, thankfully, but I did tear slightly and had some stitches with both of them. And with this baby, this 8-pounder, and at home in this environment, giving birth in the tub, I didn't have my perineum massage. I just had the midwife knowing how to turn the baby. And the way I was squatting, which was, I think, so critical, she didn't leave a scratch on me.
Mm.
And that, wow. I mean, that was incredible. Because I thought for sure I felt like I was opening up, like, impossibly, like, you know, the feeling. And I thought for sure I would need stitches. And she checked me out, and I didn't need a thing. And the healing was amazing. You know, I feel I'm completely unmarred. I don't feel like I've ever had three babies. Anyway, she came out. She didn't cry. She just came out with these big eyes that were taking it all in. She was totally conscious and with us. And my doula went to get my son, who, you know, could be present. And it was just the most amazing moment, because finally at that point, I know I'd climbed the mountain, I'd gotten to the peak, the pain was done, and the bliss just rang through every cell. And, you know, Lawrence could feel it as though he, you know, as powerfully as I did. My son came in the room, and, you know, he was totally feeling the vibe. The whole thing was amazing. My daughter actually opted out. She spent the night at a friend's house, which I think may have been for the best, because she wasn't that keen about the whole experience. So rather than forcing her to be there and, like, this is a family moment and we're all going to do this, you know, and be here, I'd really made the right decision respecting her wishes. I think it would have put added stress on me because I was making such loud sounds that our upstairs and downstairs neighbors were both calling the doorman saying, you know, should we call the police? What's going on in 5-H? And the doorman's like, no, Mrs. Rose is just giving birth. Which I think is the first time they've ever heard that before in the building.
Wow.
But they're like, wow, she must be in a lot of pain.
Oh my God.
I think my daughter would have enjoyed that for 20 hours. But at any rate, it was, you know, after that, it was all gravy, had some placenta, which set me right. My doula brought me a nice plate of placenta and a fresh fruit smoothie. And I have to say, it tasted like fresh fruit. It didn't taste bad at all. It tasted like, didn't taste like an organ. It just tasted like fruity, like a strawberry. Honestly, it didn't taste bad. I know it sounds really, really gross.
What does an organ taste like?
Well, you know, I mean, if anyone's ever had, like, chicken liver or something.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
okay.
It didn't taste like toxic cooked organ. It didn't really have a lot of taste. It was very watery. And the expenditure, of course, was superhuman. And, well, women can be superhuman when they do this. And I had this, you know, I'd gone pale and everything. And after a few minutes of digesting and assimilating some placenta, I won't say I was necessarily a rosy-cheeked wonder, but I definitely felt hugely rebalanced. And so I definitely encourage that. And Amanda, I thank you so much for giving me that that information. It was so important. And I suppose that's the story. Just wanted to just add that I did a lot of things that were very unorthodox for, and I did them because intuitively I knew it was fine to do them. And I'll share, I'm going on with this. Is it okay for me to go on?
I think it's good. I just think we might need to have another call soon. maybe sooner than a month. Yeah, to do more questions, but that's fine. I think it's good.
Yeah. Okay, because people do ask me about colonics, ask me about a lot of these things, and I do what I know is right for me, but I don't necessarily, I certainly would never recommend anyone do what I do, because you have to be the person to do what the person does. So by that I mean, I don't have fears around these things. I don't have, I've done a lot of work to get to a space where I feel very comfortable trusting myself and doing things that I believe in. I would never take anyone else's word for something and do something because they did it. I would only do it because I felt like I was ready to do it. So, in the case of the pregnancy, I was doing daily colonics. I was using my home unit, using it every day, and feeling spectacular and eating, the way I know to eat, which is, green juices. I was having lots of fresh fruit in the afternoons and mostly raw dinners. I did do some fish throughout my pregnancy because I really enjoy fish, and I desired it during the pregnancy, so I did that. I'm not of the school that one should be, vegan or vegetarian or raw or any of these things. I really think everything can have a place, as you all know. But the interesting thing was that even though I gained about 33 pounds throughout the pregnancy, and that was eating the kind of diet I eat and eliminating with my both on my own. So I'd have great elimination on my own with my pregnancy, and then I would top it up with what the home colonic would remove. And not only did I have this, 8-pound baby after that, but she is in the 95th percentile for height and has been since she was, since we went to her first doctor's visit. And my other two were never in anywhere near that range. And it's interesting because, we sometimes in the health circles, because of that concept of the tight, tiny cells and health often being diminutive, there can be a sense that, that something that's bigger is not good. And it's not the case. It's what is the small and what is the big. So if we're talking about really vibrant small with tons of energy, tons of creativity, tons of awareness and presence, then that's a good small. If you have a small that's weak and fragile, that's not a good small or isn't focusing on stuff. That's not what we want. When we talk about big, well, what is the big? Is the big a heffalump, like a galumph who doesn't like respond and just kind of, doesn't develop, doesn't roll over on time, isn't sitting up, is too heavy to kind of be sprightly? That's not a good big. She's a really good big. I'm going to describe it. She's doing all the things she should be doing and then some. I'm getting amazing comments from our pediatrician, and she's so conscious and so aware, and so I just feel like her eyes are following everything, and she's been so present since the moment she was born, which I think has a lot to do with the environment she was born into. So I think all those things play. It forced me to look at the 95th percentile in a new way, and then of course the remarkable milk that's creating that, and not feeling physically after the first few weeks. You do feel drained nursing the first few weeks, but I feel like I'm able to do my exercise, eat the way I want to eat, keep my body the way I want to keep it, and still I'm obviously having this bionic milk because she's a 95th percentile and she's made of my milk. Her bones, her skin, her blood are all being made up of my milk. So I think that's really remarkable. I think I can stop now. Now that I've gone on and on. Hopefully that will be helpful, because hopefully it will answer questions that people are having, just knowing what, you know, we've gone through. And last thing I'll say is that I've lost all my pregnancy weight, and I even was surrendering to the idea that I wouldn't. Like, I was thinking, because with the other two, I didn't really, while I was nursing in the beginning, with a lot of women, it acts as like a fat sucker and a weight sucker, and it just pulls the weight off of you. And I was never one of those women. And even knowing what I know, even with my son, I didn't struggle to lose weight with him, but I did feel like, I did categorize myself as being one of the women who hold on to the last 10 or so until the nursing is, you know, at least like the 6-month point, and really like not, you know, when you start using the fruit smoothies and the baby shakes, at the point when it's not the baby's sole source of nutrition. But in this case, and I surrendered to that because it was lingering for the first kind of 2 months. I lost the first, like, all but the last 10 pounds upon delivery, which was amazing. So I lost 20 pounds upon delivery. I think maybe there was 12 pounds or 13 pounds after that, let's say. 20 pounds upon delivery, which is amazing. And then a few pounds after that very quickly in the next like week or so. And then I was stuck with like the 7 to 10. And I was thinking, okay, well, that's going to stick around. I better just buy some new clothes and make friends with that and, you know, let it be what it is. And then, lo and behold, I turn around and I think, you know what, let me just pull out the scale. I'm curious. I'm feeling lighter. And there we go. All gone.
Wow.
So I think part of it had to do with the fact that I wasn't attached to being leaner or to being back where I was.
Definitely.
And but so it was, is it going, it does it define me, or does it like make me happier in some way? No, but it's nice evidence that the body does snap back when you keep the cells clean, when you keep the pathways open, when you have a life force body.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, everyone on this call is probably at some point on that bridge, you know, towards that, but it's always great to know that, you know, the longer and longer we do this and the more dedicated we are, then, you know, at some point things get easier, you know, in all these different areas.
Yeah.
Well, good. Natalia, thank you so much. I think that was really awesome for you to share. We're on the hour, but what do you think about, actually, why don't we open it up and see if we can do one live question. And then I have a couple that have come in too. So if anyone has a question that they want to ask right now, go ahead and press one. If not, then we can take some that have come in from the dashboard.
I also want to get to that lady, the question that, the 6-month-old and the weight loss question.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. So Heather, go ahead.
Hi, Natalia. Hi, Amanda. How are y'all doing?
Good.
Hi, Heather. Great. What can we do for you?
Thank you so much for all of the information that you give us. I had one quick question, and it's probably almost lame to ask because I'm a little down the road with this, but I have a 25-month-old, and she's still nursing, and I thought she would wean herself from what I've seen other children do, and especially girls, and she hasn't. So mm-hmm. I night weaned her, but I don't know what to do as far as during the day without, you know, one friend said, oh, just go away for a few days. And I'm like, I don't want to mm-hmm. traumatize her. So mm-hmm. do you guys have any kind of methods, any pointers that would be something more natural? Because, you know, I resigned to stay home with her and my 7-year-old. And so it would be, I don't know, I just feel like I should keep nursing her, but at the same time, it's time, you know, it's 2 years down mm-hmm. the road, and she's gotten a lot of nutrition, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How much does she understand you? How much are you able to communicate with her?
Oh, she understands everything, and she's speaking in full sentences, and yeah, she's there.
Okay, and when did you want to go away?
Well, would that be traumatizing? I could do that. It's possible.
Well, you don't have a trip planned at this point?
No, I don't.
No, okay. Okay, so is it, and how often is she still nursing? How often is she, or is she
kind of
coming to cuddle and do her thing?
Almost every time I sit down during the day.
Wow.
I'd say it's about 10 times a day.
Wow. Okay. So here's what I would suggest. I do tend to like to believe in the baby led weaning as a general concept.
Right.
But it has to work. Nothing. You know, like with mothers, you know, we can't just be giving and not receiving. So, I definitely think you have a valid reason to cut these feedings way, way back.
Right.
And I would support them definitely at this stage. But I wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't take, I would leave a couple of feedings in, say, morning feed and evening feed. And what you could do is just, say, you know, what's her name?
Soraya.
Soraya?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Soraya, mommy is, you know, is still going to, you know, be here to nurse you, but, it's really better if we just do it, you know, when you wake up for a little while and then maybe before you go to sleep or sometime in the evening, that it's not, you could even let her know it's a drain. At this stage, it is a drain on your body if you're trying to just get some rest and, you know, but you don't want her to feel guilty or bad. But I think having established times in the day when it's okay, like knowing that you're not taking you away from her, that you're taking the breast away, that you're not that you're taking the breast away, that you're going to be able to provide her with that experience in the morning and in the evening. Or for you, it might be it would be better for you at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when she needs, or you figure out like two times a day, or maybe you start with three because going from 10 to 2 might be too much. Say two or three times in the day. When you're going to be available for that, because I think really she also needs, if she's looking for comfort from you, it's also time for her to realize that she can get so much comfort from you without the breast.
Right.
Otherwise, she's going to probably tend to associate comfort with the breast too much, and not learn all the other ways that she can communicate with you and receive comfort from you. So maybe there should be an instead of, like, if you're feeling like you want to come and cuddle, like, you know, and because it will empower her to not feel like she needs to have something outside of herself anymore that she needs to put into her mouth to make her feel good. You know, she can be just being next to you, being in your arms, smelling your skin, feeling your squeeze. You know, at this point, that should be where it's going.
Right.
And that, you know, if, you know, you can give her the heads up, like, you know, I might go away with your dad for a few days or whatever it is. Like, I want to go on this vacation and, you know, and I'm going to just, you know, don't worry because, you know, when I come back, we can, you know, we'll continue this. If it's not, you know, just to kind of communicate, I'm not using the best words right now, but like to communicate to her that you're still there, that it's there's going to be a change. And, you know, and your kids, I mean, kids get, you know, they depend on your guidance, on your direction, on, you know, on your boundaries, on knowing where they should be when. I mean, this is the time for that. So you're just, this is just one of those things you're setting in place. And I think you're going to feel a huge relief when she accepts this. Hopefully she'll take it well, I suppose. If she doesn't, I would probably give it a break and revisit it. I wouldn't try and push it at that time. Just kind of put out a feeler, just test it and see how it's received. Because she might be totally cool with it. Like, you know, you might even say to her, you know, I love it that you come snuggle with me and cuddle me and that, you know, you want to be close. You know, mommy doesn't always feel like lifting her shirt up. So can we be close without that? And just see how she reacts. If she's like, oh, yeah, I don't have to stand. I can pull your shirt up every time I sit with you.
And Natalia, just a thought here, too. Anytime where there's a situation where there's something that's not best for you, Heather, so this, you know, at this point, this isn't the best situation for you, then there's another solution that exists that's best for all of you. If it's not best for you, then it's not best for any of you. You see what I'm saying? So there is another solution that exists that is better for you and for her. So, and like Natalia was saying, this opportunity to sort of put some boundaries in place and for you to stand in your power and know that you're not going to screw her up for the rest of her life if you do this now, you know, because that's the fear, then, you know, this is just one time for her to start to understand that she, within herself, has the power even to comfort herself sometimes, and that, you know, she's learning that through you right now, which is great. But I think that you standing in that strength and without regret and without fear and just saying, you know what, this isn't what's best for mommy anymore, so it's not best for any of us anymore, you know, all of us. So let's work on a new picture of how this will be.
In fact, you could even, I love that, man. It's so true. And on every level, we should always apply that. You could also use her teeth. You could say, you know what, I think we're at the teeth count now. She'd be like, well, what's the teeth count? And then you go through and you count her teeth and be like, oh, my gosh. You know, because she might wonder, well, why are you taking this away from me now? And then be like, oh, my gosh, you're such a big girl. You have enough teeth that you don't need me anymore for this. And then you're saying, like, and then she's like the big girl thing. And you're like, look, but if you still want it every now and then, I kind of understand that. So, I'll, you know, between you and me, like, if you know, like, come right if you really, but like, you know, you don't need it anymore. You're done.
Yeah.
You know, and then see how she reacts to that maybe too.
Okay. Yeah, because she's pretty sharp. She gets a lot.
I mean, I know a lot of women, myself included, who were just like, when they started biting and getting teeth, it was like, okay, well, you know, that's baby-led weaning to me because it's sore. It's painful when they start, like, you know, playing with it like it's food.
I agree.
But well done. I mean, gosh, two years you've been with, I mean, you've given her so much. She's not going to hold, and she would not hold this against you, I promise.
No way.
As Amanda said, even, you know, even if she did, you know, they got to do what's best for you.
Yeah.
At that stage, you've done your best.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm gonna give it a shot.
Thank you guys. I'm sure it'll be better, because more smoothly than you think.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, mm-hmm. Bye.
Take care. Bye bye.
You too.
Okay, so let's do the one that came in. So I really need your support this morning. My son is 6 months plus, and I have been breastfeeding around the clock. I have been completely unable to lose any weight. I went to the doctor and had extensive blood work done, and the only thing that came back was that I was low in vitamin D. I eat mostly raw and all vegan, weight lift 5 times a week, and hydrate appropriately and juice. I can't stress enough how depressed I feel about my weight. Has anyone encountered something similar? Any thoughts or advice? I do not plan on weaning, and my doctor says she thinks I will lose some weight after I've stopped nursing, but there has got to be something I can do in the meantime, right? I'm not happy with how I look or feel right now.
Mm-hmm. It's a terrible place to be, and I just feel really, you know, first of all, just really sympathetic. I understand. And I would say, first of all, what are you eating? And I don't know if she's, is she on the call? Can we communicate with her?
Or? If you are on the call, the individual who asked this question, and you would like to talk with us live, that would be great. If you do, go ahead and press 1 on your phone, and we'll see you. If not, then that's okay.
Okay, because what I'm getting at is, you know, if it's just being raw, vegan, any of these things, doesn't tell me anything as a counselor. It tells me what you're not eating. It doesn't tell me what you are eating. So I know you're not eating chicken, but, and, you know, and even tofu, you know, having, or, you know, or some of these things, but I don't know you're not eating grain probably, unless it's, but I don't know if maybe you're having raw grains and you're having lots of nuts and seeds and fruits and dried fruits. If you're having an all raw vegan diet, chances are you're not going to be able to sustain that, with nursing unless you're taking in a lot of fruits. So, and dried fruits and nuts. So I would say, I'm guessing that your diet is probably pretty dense with things like that, and it's probably, the weight's probably not shedding for the simple issue that you probably have a yeast issue. Now, it's hard to nurse without being able to consume some fruits, and I would say, if it were me, what I would do, I would get away from the whole raw concept, and I would get on to more of a detox for women approach for a food intake. So I would go ahead and do the fish, do the eggs, kill the yeast. that's the order of the day. I think at 6 months, you should be able to have plenty of milk. Your milk supply is well established without doing the fruits. Earlier in pregnancy, earlier in nursing, you usually need the fruits to get your milk supply up to scratch. But if you're doing green juices, avocado salads, lots of raw vegetables, lots of cooked vegetables, plenty of eggs, and if you can get high quality seafood, which is almost an oxymoron today, that sort of thing would be great for the denser stuff. And the baked yams, if you need something denser, those things would all be great. You know, it's all laid out for you in the detox rumen approach. So my feeling is that you're probably yeasted, and that's probably what's holding you back, and these substances you're taking in with the raw diet are only exacerbating that. Chances are there are lots of oils in those things too, like, you know, if it's the nut seed balls and the macaroons and all that stuff, there's just a lot of coconut oil, which won't help. The other thing is, again, among the unorthodox things I do, just another one of them, is that I recently, I suppose about 3 or 4 weeks postpartum, went to have hydrogen peroxide intravenously. And you see an MD for that. And I found a great integrative MD just a few blocks from me and went for these IV hydrogen peroxide treatments. And you know, it's something that everyone would have to look into and consult with their own doctor on. But in terms of killing yeast in a really efficient manner, there's nothing that's going to slay them like intravenous hydrogen peroxide. So I wanted to try this out because I know that this therapy is widely used, I should say, not so widely, it should be more widely used, but by knowledgeable doctors on fungus cancer, on all yeast conditions, Lyme disease, any physical ailment that is coming from a virus, and including HIV, virus, bacteria, or a fungus, yeast. And if you want to truly ensure that these fungus yeast are slayed in the body IV intravenous hydrogen peroxide, meaning you're getting a drip. You're getting a drip of 3% medical grade, which is different to food, different to 3% in the drugstore. 3% medical grade they start with in the IV drip, which is mixed in a saline solution. And that's something that not everyone will decide to do. There's a lot of controversy around it. I went through all the controversy like I tend to do and came out with my decision, my choice, and what I felt was right, and I'm really glad I did what I did. I think I made the right choice, and I'm really happy I had the IVs. I would have done more if I didn't have veins that didn't want to cooperate. But that's an option if you want to research that. But doing Candex and Candigon and fungal defense, oregano oil right now while you're still nursing, it won't hurt you or hurt your son. I think it said son, baby. But mm-hmm. it will come through in the breast milk. So unless your baby really likes oregano oil, he might have a really hard time nursing. So I would say probably don't do those things. Leave it to the lack of sugars in the system to starve off the yeast monster to do the work right now with killing the yeast. But I would say the combination of killing the yeast and cleaning the colon will be your 1-2 punch for fixing this condition, fixing your situation, because it's definitely fixable. And the only two things that would be an obstacle would be, is the center blocked? Is there more waste to leave? Are you rehydrating so much waste that isn't leaving, that's bloating you out, that's making you heavier, that's blocking the flow? Or do you have all this yeast that is just staying, keeping you puffy, keeping you heavy, and also contributing to the blockages and the lack of the ability of the life force to conduct, for the life force to conduct? Those are really the two big things I would see. And then, of course, you know, remove the oils or do all the things we talk about in life in Detox for Women.
Natalia, can I also bring this on another level, too?
Yeah, absolutely. Always.
Because one thing that I sense from this, and I could be totally off base, and maybe I sense it because I have experienced this myself, but is the sense of panic and fear. And I can entirely relate with this individual in that way. And I just have to say that until the source of that fear and that panic is also addressed, you're probably going to recreate this situation in the future. So it's one of these systemic things that needs to be evaluated as well. I'm not saying that in any sense of the stretch of the imagination that any of us has to sit in a body that doesn't feel good, but at the same time, what is the panic? What is the fear? Why? What will happen if you don't? Are you afraid that you're not going to be liked? Are you afraid that you're then going to be alone? Where does this fear come from? At what time in your life do you feel love was withheld from you because you didn't look a certain way, or because I also think at a collective level too, we women have this expectation and hold each other to this expectation or judgment, and it's really a judgment about ourselves, that there is a time frame that we should be back to normal and looking perfect again. And I think that's something that we need to release ourselves from, and we need to release each other from, because there could be a different experience for people. And you know, in the whole scan of this whole like stretch of our life, this is just a really short blip on the radar. And this is a short time that we spend with our children. And if we're in it, in depression and fear, is that good for us? Is that good for our children, et cetera, et cetera? So I know that when you're in this situation, that is just an annoying thing to hear, because you just want to lose the weight and you just want to be in your clothes. But remember that there's something deeper beneath that also can be looked at. And, you know, if you can do that in some very honest evaluation and meditation, there's answers there and there's healing that can be done at a really deep level that will make what Natalia is talking about doing, that it will make it so that you're doing those things from a place of love and from a vision, and not from this painful situation that's just really pushing you, you know, and kind of running you. Instead, you're saying, "I love my body. I love myself. I know that there's extra weight on me that needs to go and that can go now, and it's safe to go now. So I'm ready." You know, but from a very centered place of love, not from this panicked state that you may or may not be feeling right now. But, you know, I know that for myself that I've experienced that. So just another 2 cents there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's also true.
Yeah. So we do have another question. And Natalia, why don't we just take one more question? Because I feel this person would really love this to be addressed. And then we can do the reprogramming on another call. Does that sound okay to you?
Yeah, it does sound good. And again, my apologies if I went over with this. I wanted to put it all into one place.
Yeah, no. It's perfect. I think it's great.
Okay. I'm very happy to take your question.
Yeah. So, okay. Let's see. Hold on 1 second. All right. I started on this journey being very cautious about what my kids ate, and since studying Natalia's work, I've been a little more lenient with them, allowing more sprouted grains, goat cheese, eggs, and many of the transition foods you suggested, in addition to lots of fruit and vegetables, cooked as well as raw. Well, lately they've been sneaking food and lying about it. They're not only taking transition foods, but also daddy's food, in quotes. He supports me, but is not the least bit interested in a cleansing lifestyle for himself, so the house is full of food I don't want them to have, but they know what is his and what is ours. Am I creating this behavior by being too strict or too lenient? Are they forming food addictions? Having had compulsive eating issues all my life, I recognize these habits of sneaking and eating alone, and they scare me. Thanks so much.
Such a loaded question.
Yeah.
And there's so many levels to it. Well, first of all, how old are the kids?
She doesn't say. Would you mind writing in real quick how old the kids are? I think it's a really important question. Hopefully she's still on the call.
Okay. All right. Well, I can approach it from kind of both perspectives. So if we're talking about kids.
I got it.
Yeah.
10, 6, and 3.
And they're all exhibiting this. Well, the thing is that the 3-year-old's going to do whatever the 6 and the 10-year-old are going to do.
Right.
So, okay. So I think it's really, really tricky, and I think this is where we have to ask ourselves, what is a life force family, and a life force family, and also what is the biggest enemy of the flow of life force, and that is obstruction. We can also call it opposition. So it can either just be in the way, or it can be opposing nature. So nature is trying to go where it wants to go, and then there's this push against nature saying, no, you can't do that. And that is suppression and repression, and that can be as negative, sometimes have worse repercussions than allowing something that that seems so obviously wrong. And I, this is bringing, you know, very, very close to home, and I can speak from absolute experience in this because I have pretty much the same scenario. I don't have a kind of a, this is daddy's food, this is our food, but my husband enjoys going out to eat, and he likes to take the kids out with him, and, you know, I didn't know for a while that he was letting them have things that I would never have wanted them to have. And of course, they form addictions around those things. So in my case, I managed to get my kids, I guess, to about 7 and 9 before they seemed to go off the rails. Not off the rails, but like they just kind of weren't interested in listening to me anymore and what I had to say about food. And I took that cue and just kind of let it be what it was and decided not to force and let them do what they wanted to do. Because also part of the life force family is the mother who is generally, I mean, and there are probably a lot of men who are the center of this work in their households, but generally the mother is. And the most important thing is that the mother stays clear and open and centered. And if she feels like all of her energy has to be concentrated on controlling and having a certain outcome, then she's going to wind up actually being pretty neurotic and frustrated and all tied up and not in any way remotely what she, you know, can be and should be. So, you know, from my perspective, I want to sit in the middle of my spider web and conduct everything in my sort of nuclear family and in my realm from a very sane, clear place. And it's almost like I have my rules, but I'm also going to sit in my truth and be what I believe in. And so if one of my kids takes notice, or turns their back or does whatever they want to do, I'm still going to live my truth. I'm not going to try and twist their arm and make them see something that they don't want to see at that moment or that they can't see at that moment because they don't want to see at that moment. So the 10-year-old, I'm guessing 10-year-old is probably, you know, leading this in some way. Maybe I'm wrong, but the 10-year-old's going to do what 10-year-old's going to do. And I think at 10 years old, if the child isn't having symptoms and an ailment and understanding that they need to adhere to a certain kind of dietetic plan because otherwise their body is going to really fall apart further. They're going to have, they're on medications or whatever. You know, they're pretty much going to do what they're going to do, and I wouldn't try to force a 10-year-old. I would have a talk with that 10-year-old in private and explain, and whoever the child is kind of leading the pack, I'm guessing it's a 10-year-old, I would explain that the example the 10-year-old is setting, we're just using the 10-year-old now as an example, explain to them that they're leading their younger brother and sister down a path that's not to their brother and sister's highest good, and that you would like to be able to give them the freedom, the responsibility to take their dietetics in large part into their own hands, but that they cannot live harmoniously and imbalanced. So you want to open up the conversation for them to tell you what they would like to be able to eat, so there doesn't have to be any more sneaking. The sneaking and the hiding, that has to go. Even if it means that you have hot dogs in your refrigerator and white buns for them to make for themselves, there should not be any sneaking. So if they are going to do this, it needs to be out in the open. And everyone has to be really honest about what they want and what they're addicted to and what they're having and what they're, you know, and what, you know, you might be unhappy about it, but like bring it, but in terms of your conversation with the 10-year-old, letting the 10-year-old know so the 10-year-old can take responsibility for the fact that, that his or her behavior is the example that the other two little ones are following. And then at the very least, what you might be able to do is get remove that negative influence that's on the younger kids now, so that the older kid can feel like, okay, well, if I can remove this, if I can do what my mom's asking me to do, I can have more freedom. I'm not going to act like an imbecile with food around my younger siblings, because that's going to damage them. And the 10-year-old definitely old enough to understand that that's damaging to them. So I think that's the first step. And then once that kind of hidden behavior and that imbalanced behavior is rectified, then it's going to be a lot easier to bring the 6-year-old and 3-year-old back under mama's wing. And, you know, and that can mean a variety of things, but I certainly think that at 3 and 6, certainly at the 3-year-old, the foundation hasn't been well enough established, and 3-year-old needs to, the boundaries set around the 3-year-old should not be sneaking food. And I mean, those things are out of bounds for any kind of behavior. It would be as bad as stealing or sneaking online activity or anything else. So I think the sneaking needs to be treated at large as a crossing boundaries of the family's kind of trust. And the father has to be brought in on this, and both parents need to be clearly communicating the message that this is lying and cheating and stealing, and that this is not appropriate. Saying that you want to have a hamburger, a hot dog, a piece of pizza, a box of Nerds is one thing, and you know, and there needs to be parameters around those things if they're desired, and that if you and your spouse agree that they can have a place. I'm not saying that you will think that really has a place, but if you feel like to bring harmony in the home, those things or whatever the things are need to have a place, then the parameters need to be built around them. And so everyone's very clear about what's okay and what's not, because outside of that, it's lying, cheating, stealing, whether we're talking about food or anything else. So I do not think that in my professional experience, as well as my personal experience, I have not seen kids rebel and do this, all the things that everyone's so afraid of happening with a sort of a high consciousness diet, with a backfiring later on, unless there's been a failure to come to terms with honestly behaviors that are underneath the surface and that are festering in other ways. So I hope that makes sense. At any rate, I think it's a challenge, and I think there's compromise that's going to need to be made. I don't think it needs to be made around the 3-year-old. I think that there can be some flexibility in the 6-year-old's life, just to try and understand why they want what they want, why they're, you know, so that it's all very conscious. And then with the 10-year-old, it's time for the 10-year-old to step up as the leader of the children in the family and take ownership of his or her leadership role and setting an example. And in the meantime, mother should not get stressed. Mother should sit in her lovely, clear space and know that she can't force things. She can't oppose nature. She can only be a glowing example and set healthy boundaries for her children, and instill values in them so they won't lie, cheat, and steal. Even if whether it's where food's concerned or whether it's not, whether it's something else is concerned.
Yeah, well, and a couple sort of cliches come to mind too in terms of that. One of them is that which we resist persists. So, you know, in this scenario where this individual is resisting this behavior, it's just going to make it persist longer. And the other one is when you love something, let it go, because I think that she'll probably be pleasantly surprised to see, and maybe not immediately, because there's probably going to be that, you know, new kid off the college kind of feel like you want to blow it out sensation when they do feel that sense of freedom. But eventually, when they realize, when the novelty of that is over, and they realize that, oh, wait, no one's standing over me making sure that I eat a certain way, now I get to choose based on what really feels right for me, you may be pleasantly surprised to see that changes, that choices change. And especially if at this point they probably do understand why you were saying what you were saying, why it's so important to take care of our bodies, why if they want to be a good athlete or a dancer or anything in their life, why making good choices now is going to help them in that vision of their life. If they can have sort of understanding around that, then maybe they'll have better choices than you even think. So
yeah, and in fact, not to go on, but it brings to mind the fact, two quick things. One is that they will have symptoms, and they'll have to come face-to-face with those symptoms, whether they're getting cavities, and they have painful Novocaine shots in order to have those cavities filled, or they have other problems, exactly. It's funny because when they start to do sleepovers and things, you know, you don't know what they're doing when they're over at other kids' houses. And we don't do soda in my house. It's like soda is not... It's one of those things like hot dogs, you know, I think fundamentally we just don't, they're just not part of our vocabulary. But with sodas, my daughter came home and after a sleepover and says, you know, she's complaining, she has these sores in her mouth. I'm like, okay, well, this is interesting. This is an acidic condition. It's like a, you know, a little canker sore thing. And I used to get them when I had an acidic diet, not an external one, but an internal one. And they're painful. They're terrible. And she's complaining. And I'm like, honey, you know, have you been drinking soda? And it turns out, you know, she comes clean. She's like drinking Coca-Colas at her friend's house. And I'm like, well, you know, there's your, you know, the thing. So it goes away over the course of a few days. And then lo and behold, she's coming back from the same friend's house, and then she has it again. And I'm like, well, honey, you know, it's this, you know, it's soda. So I can't really be that sympathetic, you know, because she, you know, she wants me to, like, you know, mother her and like, oh, and she wants to complain about her ailment. And, you know, all the mothers out there can nod along because, you know, there can be so many ailments even in just one day that they'd like to get our attention to tell us about. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, with this one, I don't know what to tell you. You know, you're drinking, you know that soda equates to mouth sores. So, you know, the only way to fix it is with alkalinizing your blood. And, you know, I'm like, well, you know, so let's do that. But if you don't want to have this pain again, then don't do that other thing, you know. And in the case of something like hot dogs, you know, there are options like in the health food store, there are buffalo burgers that have no additives, which are amazing if you are someone who wants to find an alternative food. So, you know, instead of using regular hot dogs, buffalo meat, like high-quality, you know, free-to-roam buffaloes in Wyoming, forming that into hot dogs with no additives is an option. There are also buffalo burgers if you don't want to do veggie burgers. There are also so many alternatives. So if you can figure out what your kid is really after, you can, you know, you can mimic it to the best of your ability, and then maybe where they want the real thing every now and then, maybe you make that an option, or maybe you stick to your guns and don't. It's just for you to be really conscious and know that if there's blockage, if there's opposition, if there's resistance, repression and suppression, and if mommy is not able to stay centered and cool and be that glowing example, it's not going to work.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep. Okay. So, Natalia, my little family is needing me. So,
yeah, okay.
And I'm sure yours is too. So, thank you very much for this call today, and we will let you guys know when the next one's going to be. We have them scheduled for the second Tuesday of every month, but maybe we'll do one sooner. I don't know. But thank you so much, everyone, for joining. It's been awesome, and sorry if we didn't get to your questions. We will definitely reconvene and post questions on the forum and you know, help each other out as much as possible in the meantime. So thank you, everybody, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you so much, everyone. Go enjoy your Life Force family.
Okay, bye.
Bye now.